Thank you for asking me to speak here. It's a very interesting workshop. So I will talk about our work on infrared and optical properties of IGT superconductors. I will focus on three issues that have motivated by the discussion that we had 2 weeks ago at the workshop and also this morning too. So I will first talk about electron doped filtrates and their similarities with the whole doped counterparts, and I will try to address the issue of the energy gap and of the pseudo gap in the system. I think we have fairly strong evidence for the existence of the pseudo gap also on the electron dope side of the phase diagram, and I'll try to discuss this experiment. And then I will talk about impurities, impurity effects, about one specific aspect of impurity effects, namely about unusual features in the frequency dependence of the conductivity at lower energies that are, again, quite generic for several classes of high-PC superconductors, including this electron doped and some hole doped materials too. And then from a correspondence with Bob Laughlin earlier last week, I understand that there is a lot of confusion and misconception about some of the C-axis results, so I would like to talk about these experiments in a little more detail. Not all of these results are new, but some are new anyways. And what is new here is that is the following. I'll try to compare and to contrast the interlay electrodynamics of IGT cuprates and the father layered materials, layered superconductors, more conventional superconductors. This is a list of my collaborators, my students, and Jason Singley, Sasha Dordevich, Yuri Padilla, Michael Dumas, a postdoc. Some of the crystals that we looked at come from Brian Maple's group. Tom Timmons at McMaster, George Bloomberg at Lucent, Chris Holmes and Myron Strong at Brookhaven. New generation of lanthanum 214 crystals comes from Yuichi Ando. Neodymium cerium copper oxide work is a collaboration with Yamada. Our long-term collaborators from UBC, Doug Bond, Walter Hardy, and Eugene Leon. This is YBCO work. YBCO 124 comes from Dabrowski, and we collaborated with Dirk Wandermaro on one project recently. Now, Catherine advised me that at least theorists talking here should explain their motivations, why they're doing what they're doing, so I guess I have to do a little bit of that too. I have to explain why I'm using optical methods, and the short answer is that I have to. This slide shows a UC logo.
Oh yeah.
And it's common for all UC campuses, and it says here, let there be light. And sure enough, every campus has someone doing optical spectroscopy. UC Santa Barbara is, of course, ahead of everyone. Three, four excellent groups working on that. At UCSD, they didn't have anyone 3 years ago when they hired me, so I guess I just have to do this so our department complies with this logo. But seriously, infrared spectroscopy is ideally suited for the studies of superconductivity because of several reasons. Its energy range is quite unique and covers all essential energy scales in solids. This idea, this diagram gives a schematic of some of these scales and also gives an idea how to convert units. I will use wave numbers in most of my diagrams. One wave number is approximately 1 Kelvin, 1,000 wave numbers is 0.1 electron volt, and 30 wave numbers is 1 terahertz. So in this energy range, we find scales related to the energy gap and to the pseudo gap in IGT materials and the conventional superconductors too. Also scale related to relaxation processes is here, so we can study many body effects that govern the relaxation processes in these materials. Superfluid density, or more specifically, the Josephson plasmon, that is an essential feature of layered superconductors, also falls somewhere in this energy range. This is the most famous energy in high-TC problem, also somewhere here. Because the data is available in the form of optical constants, we are capable of applying model-independent tools for the data analysis. By this I mean a variety of sum rules, and from these sum rules we can learn about energetics of superconducting state, and that will try to say a few words about that too. Infrared also is a powerful probe of interactions in the electronic system, in particular interactions leading to superconductivity. In conventional superconductors, strong coupling to phonons leaves characteristic imprints on the optical constants, and this electron phonon spectral function extracted from the optical constants is an excellent agreement with Newton data and gives a lot more details than the tunneling spectra, which are most commonly cited in this context. Similar analysis when it was applied by Jules Carbot, Evel Schachinger, and myself. The cuprate signaled prominence of a Newton mode, actually, centered at this 40 MeV, but I will not talk about this work today. Also, optics is great to study in isotropic systems like cuprates, of course. We can conveniently access all diagonal components of the optical constants through experiments in the polarized light. Because of large probe and thickness of infrared radiation between micron and say 100 microns, the crystals that we look at do not need to be perfect all the way to the topmost layer. At the same time, we can work with small samples and to take a snapshot of this YDCO single crystal mounted atop of a metal cone, I had to use a scanning electron microscope. So all these factors make infrared methods indispensable for the studies of superconductors and for studies of solids in general. Okay, so I would like to start with NCCO, and this is an interesting system. Unlike most other cuprates, charged carriers in this material are electrons, and this is also common for praseodymium cerium copper oxide and samarium cerium copper oxide. There are some subtle differences between these three, but the gross features are really the same. Perhaps the most anomalous feature of these materials is that they were believed by various people to be S-wave superconductors, and experiments interpreted in terms of S-wave are numerous. And they include Raman scattering and temperature dependence of the penetration depth and microwave data and Josephson tunneling. But this experimental information is being challenged by new generation of measurements performed for better characterized samples. With infrared, we can address the issue of the energy gap and of the pseudo gap in this compound. We know that the phase diagram of electron dope and the hole dope system, the phase diagram is similar, but this particular version of the phase diagram is sort of obsolete because it's taken from 95 issue of Physics Today, and at that time we didn't know that there was this exciting and important region, phase region, the pseudo gap region, that certainly has been explored in some details on the holdout side of the phase diagram. Existence of a similar region on the electron dope side is yet to be established, and transport experiments give no indications for that. And in fact, NCCO is notorious for this nearly quadratic temperature dependence of resistivity that on the holdout side is usually found on the in the overdose samples. And this led to the proposals that NCCO perhaps is always overdosed. So we don't think this is the case.
Actually, antifermite is on the electron dope side. So that's pretty much nailed down the on the Facebook feed.
Yeah, I think that's, this is established, yes.
That's who you're talking about, I think.
Yeah, and through, yes, from Newton's cabin in the first place. But that's on in non-superconducting samples, on very strongly underdoped. You can also make it antiferromagnetic by changing oxygen, by keeping the same cerium content, and this is perhaps a little more gentle way to make it antiferromagnetic. So you look at some of these crystals. But I don't know about neutron scattering on these ones. Okay, so this slide shows the spectra of the in-plane conductivity of MCCO single crystals. In this slide and in all other diagrams, I will show the data at the lowest temperature with the blue curves, data at TC with green lines, and if I show a room temperature, that would be red. Sometimes I would show other temperatures in red, in black if this is necessary. So this is the real part of the conductivity. It stands for absorption of energy in our system, and we see that the conductivity remains finite at lower frequencies. In an S-wave superconductor, you would expect to find vanishingly small conductivity because there is no absorption allowed for energies below S-wave gap, and this is not a myth. Zero absorption, zero conductivity has been observed by Tinkham a long time ago in lead, and the behavior of NCCO is certainly very different. In fact, there is very little change between the conductivity spectra in the normal and superconducting state, and I will talk about this in a little more details in just a second. But the a key fact that follows from this diagram is this huge absorption in the intragap region at frequencies way below expected BCS gap. Some kind of residual absorption is universally found in the in-plane conductivity of whole-doped materials, and this diagram compares NCCO results with the data for perhaps the most studied high-BC superconductor for YBCO. You can see that the conductivity also remains finite at lower energies and also increases. At least qualitatively, this finite conductivity in the superconducting state can be described in terms of, can be understood in terms of D-wave features shown by Peter and by Jules Carbot some time ago. Again, I repeat, all materials, all whole dose materials that have been accurately looked at low energy, their low energy absorption is always finite, it's always gapless. So on the basis of this residual absorption, I think S-wave state in simple S-wave state in NCCO materials is really ruled out. Now, in order to examine the in-plane, the key feature of the conductivity at somewhat high energies is, again, the key features are similar in this MCCO material and in YBCO. The key feature is this minimum anchored around 500 wave numbers, in fact, in all cuprates or in most cuprates. And in order to discuss this feature in a little more details, it's instructive to analyze the data in terms of the energy-dependent scattering rate. And I would like to quickly remind you what are the characteristic patterns that we find in the energy-dependent scattering rate.
Dimitri, can I just ask, these spectra, the various conductivity things, is that with just the straight total conductivity, or is that with some photons removed from it, or?
No, nothing is removed.
Nothing removed.
Just what reflectance. Phonons are actually here, but the phonon contribution is so weaker than the electronic contribution of the in-plane. You see that this is not noise; these are indeed infrared active phonons. But they can be easily separated, so there is no need to do any subtraction to see what's happening.
And the other thing that just seems obviously different between those is this sort of peak at 50 wave numbers or 60 or whatever it is.
I'm glad you spotted it, yes. I will talk about this in a little more detail, yes. This is also a log scale. I'm emphasizing this peak behavior. That's precisely the reason why I've chosen the log scale for this plot. So this energy-dependent scattering rate. At optimal doping, the energy-dependent scattering rate is nearly linear as a function of energy. And this behavior is believed to be a counterpart of linear temperature dependence of resistivity that one again commonly finds at optimal doping. However, below TC, the behavior is a little more interesting. The low energy scattering rate is suppressed at frequencies, say, below 500 Wave numbers, forms this, but then increases and forms this threshold structure. And the frequencies, say, about 1,000 wave numbers, it's indistinguishable from the data at TC. An interesting feature of underdoped materials is that these changes in the energy-dependent scattering rate occur already in the normal state. This threshold structure in the behavior of 1 hour tau is clearly visible at TC, and there is very little change in this behavior with sample becoming superconducting. We found the same features in the frequency dependence of 1 hour tau spectrum, the same trends with doping in other classes of IPC superconductors, in BISCO, for example. So this makes us believe that these features indeed reflect some generic trends in the charge dynamics in the copper-oxygen planes. So this diagram shows the scattering rate extracted from the optical constants for NCCO. Again, this is thin plane data, and compares that to what we observe in the optimally doped 5DCO. So this shape of the spectrum that we find at lowest temperatures is not really different from what is observed in most other Coopers. The spectrum reveals this threshold structure that we see on the whole doped side of the phase diagram. At higher energies, the spectrum flattens out and varies nearly linearly with energy. We find no change in the scattering rate below the temperature of superconducting condition, and that's of course the difference from the optimally doped YDCO. However, this particular aspect, the similarity in the data above TC and below TC, is perhaps similar to what is going on the underdoped side of the phase diagram of YDCO. By the way, we are confident that the crystal is superconducting. We measured these measurements have been performed on the AC phase of the crystal, so we can rotate the polarizer and we can look at the C-axis properties, and we find the development of the strong plasma edge just below the temperature of superconducting transition. So this particular crystal, this particular phase of the crystal is definitely about superconductor. So it's still, there is very little change in the in-plane dynamics.
Is the green and the blue curves on top of the black and the green on top of each other?
Actually, there is a little trace of green here. I don't know if you can see with this.
Is it blue and green or black and green?
That's blue and green. Black is apikelvin.
Okay.
And green, you really can't see it.
Okay.
At least in SVGA resolution. So maybe some better resolution, but they really coincide. It's somewhat similar to the response of underdoped whole-doped materials, which become gapped at temperature well above TC. Here, most radical changes in the optical constants occur somewhere between room temperature and TC, and there is very little change with superconducting condition. One difference, of course, of NCCO from, say, this material is that the gap shape of the spectrum persists all the way up to room temperature. And so if I were to stick to the pseudo-gap interpretation of this result, then I have to conclude that T star, the pseudo-gap temperature in this material, is about 300 Kelvin. normally we are confident of the pseudo-gap interpretation of the data if we are capable of showing that these features of the pseudo-gap disappear, either with temperature or with increasing doping. We do not have this information, at least not at the moment. We know that the attributes of the pseudo-gap, this threshold behavior, persists in the underdoped antiferromagnetic materials, in which cerium content is the same, but oxygen is somewhat different. However, we didn't have a chance to look at the overdoped side of the phase diagram because of samples issue. It's very hard to prepare overdoped NCCO compounds. Thus, the conclusion of the pseudo-gap in this material comes mainly from this shape of the frequency-dependent scattering rate. And because this shape is quite characteristic, we believe that this evidence is fairly strong. Also, from this data, we would expect that the resistivity should show a crossover to a flatter behavior at temperatures not much above 300 Kelvin. And there are no published resistivity results above the room temperature. But when I mentioned this to Reed Green a few weeks ago, he said that that's exactly what they're seeing, and he was going to remeasure some of the optimally doped samples. In other words, resistivity is quadratic only below room temperature, and above room temperature flattens just that, like this energy dependence of the scattering rate. So that might be another indication for the pseudo-gap from the transport data. Now, I would like to talk about another feature of the in-plane dynamics, about this upturn of the low energy dependent scattering rate. And this upturn originates from this peak that John just noticed, the peak in the frequency dependent conductivity. This shape with a peak at finite energy is qualitatively different from the Drude behavior, because the Drude mode is always centered at omega equals zero. So this is qualitatively different. I would like to bring this feature to your attention because I think it so far has been ignored, and maybe there are no reasons to ignore it because this behavior is quite generic in cuprates. In this slide I show three materials that reveal this peak at finite frequency. NCCO, very similar behavior we observed in single layer BISCO. This is the data from Tom Kimmel's group that shows the conductivity for tri-layered mercury compound. And again, in all these materials, the conductivity has a form of a peak centered at 10-20 millielectron volts. We have reasons to believe that this peak is observed only in disordered materials. Now, there are all reasons to expect NCCO to be disordered, because it's very difficult to achieve homogeneous distribution of cerium. But even if it's more or less homogeneous, it's still random doping. And the same problem occurs with lanthanum substitution in 2-1 system. This is probably the most disordered IPC superconductor, because copper and mercury sites are occupied. Some of the mercury sites actually occupied by copper, and other way around. That's how you make this crystal stable. So this is
that's known from X-rays or
yeah, I think that's and still this is the record holding DC material. So it doesn't seem to matter too much. But the electrodynamics is sensitive to this. And in agreement with this view that the peak is initiated by disorder, we find no trace of such peak in clean crystals. In optimally doped YBCO and optimally doped BISCO, the conductivity is much more Drude-like, at least it increases monotonically towards low frequencies. However, when we deliberately put disorder in the samples, this peak is indeed is found in the connectivity, and this is our data for YBCO1-4 material, in which we substitute copper in the copper-oxygen planes with zinc. So this is the pure crystal zinc-free. As zinc content increases, the conductivity is no longer monotonic. It forms this peak at around 10 MeV. With increasing zinc content, the C goes down. This is non-superconducting crystal. The energy position of the peak hardens, and the oscillator strength increases. Yes?
What's the meaning of the little wimpy lines that connect to the axis?
This is the region in which the conductivity is not affected by the form of the low energy extrapolation. This is the region where the conductivity, this is extrapolated region.
Extrapolated by what?
I think it's the fluid extrapolation here, but the point is that the peak is observed in the region that is not affected by extrapolation. So I think we have data actually extending to lower frequencies than this, but some of the region at low frequencies is becoming affected by extrapolation. So, but it's not an artifact of Carnot-Schwarzschild. That's my key point here. So this set of data clearly links the emergence of this peak with impurities, with doping of copper-oxygen planes with zinc. Another very important thing here, this blue area between the two conductivities quantifies the spectral weight of the superfluid. And we can determine this area quite accurately from Perel-Glover and Summerall. This is merely the spectral weight that ends up on the delta function below GC. And this weight is suppressed as zinc doping progresses. So the strength of this finite energy peak is connected with pair breaking. It's connected to the reduction of the strength of superconducting condensate. Perhaps the most striking result, and the most difficult, at least for me to understand, is that this peak at finite energy in the conductivity, in the energy-dependent conductivity, still coexists with metallic resistivity. This is difficult to understand because usually a peak like this would be a sign of presence of localized state in our system. And if localized states are present, then you would expect some form of activation, and you would expect this to show up in resistivity. If we look at the conductivity of, say, amorphous semiconductors that are not actually very different from what is observed here, then the temperature dependence of resistivity is activated. Like, we are confident that the resistivity of NCCO crystals and of these samples is in fact metallic. It's becoming probably somewhat, well, at least I don't know if activated is a good term, but it shows a semiconducting upturn in the most disordered samples. Because this peak, one piece of information that perhaps helps to understand that comes from photon emission. And the recent experiments from Lausanne show that in zinc-doped disco crystals, close to pi zero regions, some localized states are emerging. And in our experiments, we clearly see that the formation of the peak is connected to the destruction of pairs with impurities. So maybe this peak is somehow reflecting the situation along close to the pi zero region of the Fermi surface, and that's why it's not showing up directly in the in plane resistivity. Yes.
So how do you define metallic? In other words, what's the measurement that you use to say it's metallic?
I mean, just from the slope. It's a
slope of
resistivity.
So
about TC. So we are confident that resistivity, say, of NCCO crystals is maybe quadratic, below the room temperature. And the resistivity of these samples is, residual resistivity is somewhat higher, but it still has this slope.
So the idea would be that that is all due to quasi-particles along the pi over 2, part of the 2 direction, or near, you know.
Yeah, well, that's the dominant region.
For transfer.
But for the superfluid, the dominant region is probably where the gap is the strongest. And here we can link this peak to the structure of pairs, presumably somewhere around here. Yes?
If you had a Kondo effect, wouldn't you have this kind of peak at TK? Just a very naive question.
I don't know. I'm not aware of examples.
Dimitri,
yes?
Could you just remind your mid-infrared band?
Mid-infrared band is way above. That's 2,000-3,000 wave numbers. So here we are talking about very far infrared properties.
Yes, do you have any experiments on these low TC samples have been able to suppress the superconducting field and look at the resistance?
Not in zinc though. I'm aware of praseodymium though. But that would be a nice thing to do. Okay.
So actually, going back from the chart, so we asked, within the same zinc dope samples that people in the normal scale, the NMR and so on, see evidence for local moments or because of different.
No, well, these are not the same samples, but presumably these crystals would also show this behavior, yes.
So NMR has not been done on these?
Not on this particular one, but I think our rules will look at 1 to 4. Definitely. Okay, so... Actually, an interesting explanation for this peak behavior has been recently proposed by Lupi and the group from Rome, and that's their peak in the characteristic of single-layer disco. And what they found is that they can fit this data very nicely with the theory of Emery and Kirilson in 93. They had a paper for showing calculations for the optical conductivity in one-dimensional electron gas in which three electron gas in which charge, there is some charge scattered by bound charges, and the conductivity that they would expect has a form of this peak. And of course motivation for these bound charges would be some kind of reminiscence of stripes, but the fit is really good. So ideas of phase separation, ideas of this two-phase situation are certainly relevant to what is going on in zinc dope 1 to 4, because we know that zinc introduces moment on neighboring copper sites and is leading to a situation coined as CSG is essentially naively, I guess one can think of regions from which superconductivity is expelled, and this was shown by Marcel Franz and Catherine and John and McMaster group, that these kind of ideas allows to come up with much better understanding of superconducting properties. So this two-phase situation is very relevant and allows to understand properties better. Another possible explanation, so searching for the origin of this peak, one probably can involve analogy with one-dimensional conductors. And in one-dimensional conductors, when they're clean, the conductivity has a form, is dominated by a collective mode that has a form of a very narrow Drude mode. And when impurities are added and when this corrective mold is becoming thin, the ships wait for final damages, and that's exactly what's going on in Zinsko disco. So to complete with this part, with impurities and the finite energy peak, I would like to mention just very briefly one other interesting type of impurities, this neodymium doping in lanthanum 214. And this doping is interesting because neodymium is known to stabilize stripes. The top panel here shows the data for pure lanthanum 214 film, and this panel shows the data for neodymium doped crystal. And the green lines, the normal state conductivities, are essentially the same, but the conductivity in the superconducting state is very different. In this neodymium doped sample, the residual conductivity is strongly enhanced, and that occurs as the result of suppression of the superfluid density. So I think this experiment clearly demonstrates the competition between statics, between stripe ordering and superconductivity. And certainly this is very similar to what is going on in zinc dope widened CO crystal. So,
and that doesn't change much if you go below 8 I mean, you're implying that that sort of
the
low temperature behavior
is like 8K. Well, ideally, they have done microwave measurements on these crystals. So the penetration depth, this estimate, this is fairly low superfluid density, but it's also consistent with the microwave work. So that's that's a fairly reliable number. And clearly, the lower energy absorption is enhanced. And I think we can link enhancement of this absorption with some kind of inhomogeneous superconducting state, either in the form of stripes in, like in this system, or in the form of these normal cavities in zinc dope compound. There was one problem with this data. They were not very consistent with the resistivity results, and recently we extended these measurements to lower frequencies, and this data shows the conductivity of neodymium doped lanthanum 214 crystal at somewhat lower energies. Those, you can clearly see this peak in the energy dependent conductivity. Yes, sir.
Well, since you mentioned the microwave data, you know, for a long time there were very large residual conductivities measured in all microwave experiments as well, particularly on films. And in the end, Bond and his collaborators between the YBCO samples, and this, most of this residual conductivity went away. So my question is it possible that some of these residual conductivity effects could be due to some extrinsic weak links or something on the surface of the materials?
Of course, it's possible, and probably, you know, if someone works on this system for another 10 years, maybe it will be as good as YBCO 143, but I guess the point that I try to make, when you deliberately put these impurities, you enhance this absorption, and that's what is happening. Also, the peak like this certainly requires, we can no longer think of the low temperature, low frequency conductivity in terms of two-fluid model. There is something else. And the peak can be actually quite low in frequencies, probably. It's the case in last Johansson data.
So one explanation of this peak you're saying is stripes. Is
it? Well, no. And actually, those who are interested in stripology, they know that this in this material stripes become statically ordered only below 80 Kelvin. You can clearly see the peak. Temperatures well above.
Right. Yeah, I was wondering about the mercury compound with 30 kK.
No, I think these are not stripes. This is inhomogeneities in any form. I don't think we have any single indication for the one-dimensional elements in these materials from the optical contrast. From other data, maybe we can have a little bit more, but. Here, what
do
I'm
you
trying
think these results suggest that if you can get rid of that peak, you get a higher TC?
Yeah.
And So that's interesting for the mercury compound.
Oh, you mean the mercury from the wrong temperature?
It's called noise called heat.
That's probably right, yeah.
Well, why do you say it's not stuck? I mean, what's... You said about the altering of the stripe, but the stripe will also contribute about the altering temperature.
Right, but we also see it in the materials where definitely there are no stripes, but the materials that are just inhomogeneous. So, like zinc dope 1-4. So I think it would be a much safer statement on my part.
Stripes, I mean, in the general sense of the charge density way.
That
forming because of impurities or because of spontaneous, I mean, does it?
I don't think I have enough information to prove that it's a very exciting, you know, possibility that the peak somehow is related to one-dimensional.
Not necessarily one-dimensional, but charge ordering, that's the question.
Yeah, but then you wouldn't call
it a
stripe.
What?
It's
whatever you like, a charge ordering
is something. No, that's the point. You see the peak without ordering. At temperatures above the temperature of charge ordering, like 150 Kelvin,
right.
Or even at room temperature, there is some kind of a peak already here. So ordering is probably not required to see this peak, but the inhomogeneous state is required. So in this sense, it's not inconsistent with the Stripes ideas, but it's not a proof.
In your early papers, when you disordered these sensitive helium ions or something, you made a suggestion about localization being responsible for the peaking. I remember right that the idea was that even in a disordered normal metal, there were some early papers which showed these effects in the frequency-dependent conductivity. Is that correct?
I think the earliest work is work of Jim Allen on 2D gas, where they saw the peak like that in the energy dependent conductivity, and the energy position of the peak actually correlated with activated gas that you can extract from the resistivity data.
Is it a localization effect?
That could be a localization effect. So that's another another possibility.
That wasn't the Allen interpretation.
For the 2D gas, I think that was the...
It was, okay.
Yeah. No, that was... Okay. Now I would like to... How much time do I have?
Like
15 minutes. Okay. So I'd like to switch to the interlayer properties and go through some of the amazing facts about interlayer properties. Perhaps the most interesting thing is that the C-axis behavior of many cuprates is nearly insulating. And you see that from the raw reflectance data, the C-axis spectrum of plankton up to 1-4 crystal, for example, is dominated by the sharp phonon peaks. There is some weak upturn at low frequencies that is a signal of, weakly metallic behavior, but this metallic behavior is suppressed in the pseudogap state, and resistivity of these materials along the C-axis is semiconducting. So this behavior is strongly affected by the pseudogap state. Now, below TC, we observe the development of this sharp plasma edge in the conductivity, and this is due to our ability to pass superconducting current around any direction in this. I wish it was that simple to measure that. actually, these frequencies go pretty low. You go to maybe 250 gigahertz, and that's sometimes amazing how low one can get with light, with doing optical spectroscopy. So next generation of computers will have 2 gigahertz processors, and with this optical spectroscopy, a couple of 100 gigahertz. So the superconducting response is dominated by the sharp plasma edge, and at this moment, we are fairly confident that this insulating behavior above TC and strong superfluid response below TC are in fact closely connected to each other, and that's what I would like to, this connection is what I would like to discuss in the remaining minutes. And from emails with Bob, I understand that there is a lot of confusion about this, so please ask me as many questions.
What's the confusion?
The confusion is the confusion is what's going on with the spectral weight in the conductivity in the pseudo gap state and in superconducting state. And we knew about the semiconducting resistivity for quite a long time, but it was unclear what was the origin of this behavior. It was unclear before Chris Holmes and Tom Timmers had done these measurements on underdoped 1-3. And in which they've shown that the conductivity is suppressed at low frequency, and this spectral weight shown in red in this diagram is transferred to higher energies. The energy scale associated with this transfer in YBCO is yet to be determined. And in the in-plane, nothing like that is happening. The in-plane in response is becoming more metallic in the pseudo gap state. The spectral wave moves to lower energies, and somehow Bob felt uncomfortable with that. So, but this is the experimental fact. This is again not an artifact of Kramer's chronic analysis, as it was suggested, because similar experiments were repeated later on using ellipsometry measurements, and ellipsometry is the technique that directly yields the optical constants at the expense of perhaps somewhat more restricted energy range. And the results that Chris and Tom have obtained and that we obtained for other materials have been repeated with ellipsometry. So this is not related to Kramer's chronic artifacts. Yes.
Okay, but some weight, as you showed from your reflectance curves, goes into the delta function.
I'll come to that.
Okay.
Okay. The situation in lanthanum 214, experimental picture in lanthanum 214, is a little bit better, is a little bit more complete. Again, there is this depression of the conductivity in the pseudo gap state, and again, the spectral wave shows to higher energies. And in the case of lanthanum 214, we actually know a little bit better where it goes. It goes at energies above 0.4 electron volts, and the sum rolls are recovered by 1 electron volt, and we recently repeated this result on a new set of crystals. So it appears that there is some kind of a high energy reservoir in the conductivity that is capable of attracting this low energy spectral wave. And this suppression, of course, of the conductivity is the fact responsible for semiconducting uptrends of the resistivity that are found both in underdoped YBCO and in lanthanum 214. So that's the pseudo gap state. Now let's look at what's going on in the superconducting state. And actually not much is going on. The conductivity is a little bit suppressed. There are no new features in the conductivity that can be assigned to superconducting gap. There is this a little bit of this depression, but we know that's initiated in underdoped crystals already above TC. So it's, in a sense, just a continuous, you know, behavior. At the same time, we know from the reflectance data that there is strong superfluid response in these materials. And we can determine the superfluid density, the area under this delta peak in a variety of ways. And I'll skip this part, but we know this value quite accurately. And then we also know that this further depression of the conductivity at low frequencies actually accounts for only a small fraction of the spectral weight stored in the delta function. Even if we assume that this entire blue area is transferred to delta function, in some crystals this fraction can be as small as 5%. And actually I can argue against this assumption that I think nothing really prohibits the spectral wave to go from going up. This is just an assumption that goes on with this parallel thinking. Some real argument, but even if it's true, that's still only a small fraction of the total superfluid density. And it appears that the remaining portion of the condensate has to come from high energy. And a little more formal statement of this cartoon is in terms of this sum rule. So we have an additional term for the conventional ferro-Glover-Tingham sum rule, additional term that stands for the high energy contribution to our delta function. And we can interpret this contribution in terms of kinetic energy change.
The arrow was what, when you cool, or what? What's the direction of the arrow? When you cool?
Yes. Yes.
So when you cool, speculative flows into the delta function.
When we cool from room temperature to TC, the spectral wave goes here.
So basically, this is really
what's the direction of the arrows then?
When we cool below TC, some of this weight of the delta function may come from this range, but most of it actually comes from higher energy. That's what we think. It's very hard to prove it through explicit, you know, sum rule analysis, because error bar, the changes are small and the error bars are huge here.
You really take this delta K like outside your sum rule? I mean,
yeah.
Like you really think in principle if you can measure your conductivity perfectly at all frequencies, it wouldn't all go into the sum rule?
I hope, yeah.
You think it's really outside the sum rule?
Yeah.
You think it would go inside the sum rule?
Well, if we measure this to infinity, then this should be...
Delta K would be zero.
Okay, so this is...
But you don't have that type of accuracy, and you know it's...
Right,
so,
exactly.
But you can argue that it's all happening at very high energy, so this is a way of...
Yeah. And unfortunately, it's very hard to show that this is happening through the explicit sum rule analysis because of the error bar issues. However, we know that these discrepancies effect is this non-zero delta K is indeed connected with the supergap because it's observed primarily in underdoped crystals. And this is understandable, I hope, from this diagram, because the supergap is responsible for the suppression of the conductivity in far infrared. And so we are left in far infrared with the weight that is insufficient to account for the remaining fraction.
So what happens if you look at optimal delta K?
Nothing of this is happening. So delta K is zero.
And so in optical doping, you don't see any of this transfer to high energies in either direction.
No.
Some world works fine.
I'll have a diagram on that. However, it's not entirely hopeless to show that there is a broad energy scale involved into the condensation of these materials, and that recently we came up with somewhat different analysis, and I'll try to run through it very quickly. This analysis is based on the examination of the C-axis penetration depth as a function of DC conductivity in a variety of Cooper rays. And back in 1994, together with Tom Timmerskrieff, shown that the C-axis penetration depth is systematically suppressed with increase of DC conductivity. We had only a few points, but subsequent work has proven that this is indeed a universal result for underdeveloped materials.
DC
zero temperature.
That's zero temperature.
What's sigma DC?
Sigma DC at TC.
So
at
TC, that's the incline.
No, that's all C-axis.
That's a C-axis?
That's all C-axis.
Sorry, okay.
What happens if you plot the C-axis for this mistake, extrapolate zero temperature? Yeah, that's very insulating.
Well, actually not much will happen because it's a log scale and there are 5 decades here. So it's more like an astrophysicist scale.
Isn't it like a relation you get in the Josephson junction?
Yes, it's the relation that you get in the Josephson junction.
And here you have both optimal dope as well as underdope?
Here only, I'll show optimal dope in a second. Okay. Here only underdope. What we didn't know, and this is a recent result, that similar behavior is observed in other classes of layered superconductors, including organics of ET series sulfide, selenide, strontium ruthenate. And the main difference in this plot is that this lambda versus sigma line is shifted up by one order of magnitude. This difference implies dramatic enhancement of the energy scale associated with the condensate in high TC materials. And to illustrate that, I will use the Duda model. And within the Duda model, 1 over lambda squared is this is simply weight on the delta function, that's simply this shaded area. And I can determine this area either through integration, or I can say that roughly this area is given by 2 delta times sigma dc. So broader is the energy scale from which the condensate is collected, so shorter is the penetration depth, so lower is the offset of lambda versus sigma line in this diagram.
The slope of that line is 1/2?
Yes, okay. And this group theory of course suggests 1/2 slope, and experimental slope here is 0.57, so pretty, pretty close.
But that's a nice, simple argument, but it doesn't work for the AB plane, right? You have the same picture for the AB plane. You don't have the same graph.
This is a Dirty Limit argument, so it does not have to work in the AB plane, but actually we can discuss that later. But no, this is all C-axis. For C-axis, there are reasons to expect it to work. Now, for many materials on the upper line, we know that the scale associated with the condensate is about 3.5 millierecton volts. And therefore, this suppression of line for cuprates by one order of magnitude implies that this energy scale has to be two orders of magnitude broader, following this argument. And that brings us to about 1/2 electron volt, and that's the value that we extracted from the Summerall. At least it's a huge scale, but it's consistent with what follows from the Summerall analysis. Interestingly, all materials on the upper line are thermal liquids, and by this I mean that they show characteristic oscillations of resistivity in magnetic field. These oscillations are never found in underdoped cuprates. And if signs of thermolytic behavior are observed in cuprates at all, then they are observed only on the overdoped side. And curiously enough, overdoped compounds derail from this universal cuprate line and are leaning towards the thermolytic camp. So this implies that the energy scale is shrinking as you go from this line to this red line, and this is again confirmed by the Summerall by explicit Summerall analysis. We do not find any anomalies with Summeralls in these on the overdoped side of the phase diagram. So to reiterate, we observe two patterns of in the behavior of lambda versus sigma, one in conventional thermoliquid superconductors with low energy scale, the other in underdoped cuprates with huge energy scale, and overdoped materials fill this region between
the... Can you repeat? Oh, you identified this energy scale. That's where the weight shifts behind the regime.
Yeah, that's, I need to integrate connectivity up to this energy.
To get
that much of superfluid density,
okay.
The amount of superfluid density that I have on this universal cuprate line.
And so optimal doping is somewhere in there. Does it fall close to the underdoped line or closer to the Fermi-Liquid line?
Optimally doped goes to the Fermi-Liquid line. Okay, I missed my slide. So just in the remaining 1 minute, if I may, I just want to discuss few implications of what is going on here. First of all, this condensate scale that we extracted for cuprates, for underdoped cuprates, appears to be the largest scale in the problem of high TC superconductivity. It seems to be the scale from which the condensate is collected is completely unrelated to symmetry. two plates that derate superconductors, and on the upper line we find the bouquet of symmetries. Organics may be D-wave or maybe S-wave, and strontium ruthenate is P-wave, is it S-wave, so symmetry seems to be not important at all, yes.
Do you have any understanding of why all those three different materials should have the same energy scale?
No, they have roughly, yes, I think I do. I think DC for these materials is also roughly the same between 2 and, say, 10 Kelvin. So if you scale by TC, you will reduce scattering of these beta points around the upper universal line, but that's all what can happen. So symmetry seems to be not important. There is no connection between this energy scale and TC or T star, and that there is no connection to T star is somewhat more surprising, because the pseudo-gap state is in fact responsible for some of these anomalies that we find with the Bose energy scale in underdog region. So what seems to be important is coherence. And in underdog materials, superconductors, unlike these from the liquid superconductors, in these materials, superconducting state emerges from the normal state in which quasi particles are either overdamped or non-existent at all. And the regime of this incredibly strong scattering, it's possible that the entire spectral function is affected by the superconducting transition. So there is some confirmation of that following from the photoemission measurements. Of course, the weight and the electronic weight in the spectral function is not confined to a narrow region close to the Fermi energy, as it happens in these materials. And so the energy gap is in this case completely unrelated to superconductivity. I think I'll skip these other slides and I'll go to the summary. So we observed strong distinctions in the C-axis electrodynamics in high TC materials and in conventional superconductors. We observe this broad energy scale involved into the formation of condensate in underdoped materials. This broad energy scale can be interpreted in terms of changes of kinetic energy, and there are three theories at least that believe that the lowering of kinetic energy is the driving force for superconductivity. I also discussed electron-doped materials, and here we find no indications for the S-wave state, and we find strong similarities in important features of charge dynamics between hole-doped and electron-doped compounds. And then I talked about this lower energy peak that we also commonly find in residual absorption of variety of high-TC materials, a peak that is difficult to reconcile with metallic resistivity. Thank you for your attention.
Are there additional questions? Yes. Well,
the electrons of compound for these rare earth with large moments, I think this is all related to this, this peak.
We certainly would like to check that, and we would like to look at the praseodymium doped and samarium doped samples. Now, the ordering, magnetic ordering in the neodymium one, I think occurs below 2 Kelvin, and the implications of that for, say, temperature dependence of the penetration depth are found below 4 Kelvin or something like that. So our measurements are in fact the temperature higher than that. So probably not. And it's so similar to the peak in other materials where there is no this issue of magnetic ordering.
Okay.
This is a question for anybody who knows something about it. I don't. The statement that the interlayer tunneling theory provide some accounting for the CX's seminal violation in the hall. Does that mean that any theory which starts with 2D superconductivity and then you get 3D transition because of recoupling between the planes will give such an effect? Or does it have to be the specific theory of Williams and Chandler? Sorry, it's unfair to ask you maybe, but if anybody else knows, I wanted an answer to that. I'm just curious.
I think this was addressed in Anderson's article in Science back in 1995, and also Bernie Reagan had something like that. I think in convention, I think you really have to have no tunneling between the planes in the normal state, and it's claimed that maybe this can occur only in this non-thermoelectric state. If you have non-thermoelectric behavior as your starting point, you have a conventional Josephson junction. I think this is not happening. Of the build out of two, BCS superconductors.
Yeah, I think Pines and Levin and that whole body of work, they put in a very small T in the C-axis direction.
So normalized normal state hopping.
Yeah, so because they start with a Fermi liquid, that by definition, has to be metallic in all directions, although it can be highly isotropic. So they put in just a very, very tiny T in the C-axis. And they say that they can predict experimental results in that picture, whereas Anderson and others would start from some non-Fermi liquid where there really is no metallic behavior in the C-axis in the normal state.
But that's exactly what I'm asking. Does this particular experiment, do we just distinguish between those two?
Yeah.
Can Kathy Levin account for this result?
Out of curiosity, we analyzed the penetration depth in conventional Josephson junctions, and although they are not plotted in this diagram, but they do fall on the upper line, and they continue this behavior. Actually, you can have quite a range of conductivities across the junction in another niobium or in some other cases. So the energy scale there is low. We also looked at the penetration depth in granular superconductors because it was claim that maybe we can understand some of the features of the phase diagram of cuprates starting from granular materials. Granular materials also on the upper line. So there is no indication, at least from this kind of an approach to energy scales and to kinetic energy changes, that conventional materials, even when they are prepared in these unusual forms like granular or Josephson junctions, show any signs of this behavior.
You really thought the straight line that, to continue your question, I thought the straight line that differentiates Anderson from other theories, it's the scale.
And that's what I'm saying, this conventional material continues this upper straight line. Mm-hmm. The points will be here.
When you say you analyzed the Josephson junction, what was your model?
Oh, there is no model here. That's the good thing about this plot, because this is just penetration depth that can be measured. And this is DC conductivity that can be measured. And model comes next.
You said you had a model of Josephson junctions which fit the upper line.
It doesn't fit. The data fall on the upper line. So that suggests that
which data? I thought it was
for the Josephson junctions.
From conventional.
Well, other people did that, so not.
They took a Josephson junction array of conventional superconductors.
Yes.
Okay, because I guess they let it down here is something like a Josephson junction array of
unconventional. That's right.
So, because I guess in the conventional Josephson junction array, there is a relation between the energy, the critical current. And the critical current is the Josephson coupling, and the gap, the BCS gap, is actually the voltage, right? So that gives you the resistance. So here you might say
that's the gap.
BCS gap, right? It's a higher gap. Or
that's right. I don't even want to call it gap because its scale is vast. It's half electron volt.
It's not the gap idea, but you say it's much larger.
It's still even larger than that.
Okay.
Okay, well, it's time for tea and cookies, so.
Okay, great.